road.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast.
Good Trash Genre Cast.
Good Trash Genre Cast.
This is the story of dreams that came true, and in the process, shattered a childhood, a career, and a family.
My name's Dustin Sells.
But from fame came misfortune.
And he said, please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. And as she turned around to say goodbye to him, he collapsed and passed out on the floor.
I am Arthur Gordon.
Was over the top. His humor crude, often shameless.
The boys teased him a great deal and called him a sissy and bullied him.
I am Dalton Stewart.
He had a short temper. He had a short fuse.
I had to fight a lot growing up.
And you don't mess with him.
Unless you were the opposite sex.
He really learned a lot about girls and how to relate to them. And frankly, he became a ladies' man at a very young age.
Get together and talk about movies that you would not study ordinarily in a film studies course. However, we're in a little special time right now. You may have noticed from our introductory music, we're looking at Docu-December or Docu-cember.
We're wrapping it.
This is the last session thereof. It is also our last show of the year 2013, and we're going to look back on 2013, and there will be rewards. But before we get to that, we got to talk about this week's movie and make some introductions. I begin to my right, if you would, sir.
I am Arthur Gordon, and I have been sweating chlorophyll green for a week now.
Have you? Fantastic. And to my left.
My name is Dalton Stewart, and do you see that writing? You see what, do you know what that means? Hospitality. And you cannot piss on hospitality. I won't allow it.
Unless you do. And he lets it happen. Nonetheless, my name is Dustin Sells.
What are you going to do to me, Daddy?
Tighten my belt by one knot.
That's not what you think he's going to say. Because that is an exchange that should probably lead to the phrase, I'm going to molest you. It's really a horrifying scene. Probably the scariest part of Troll 2, in fact.
My name's Justin Sells, and you know what you need to make popcorn? You just got to heat it up. And that's what I intend to do this week for this show. And we are going to be talking about a movie called Best Worst Movie. It's a movie about a movie, so you might want to know a little something about Troll 2, as well as the documentary that we're examining, Best Worst Movie, which is about the cult-following fandom of Troll 2. But before I say too much about it, let's let the boys of the cinema go ahead and read that IMDb synopsis.
A look at the making of the film Troll 2 and its journey from being crowned the worst film of all time to a cherished cult classic.
So we're not saying you had to watch two movies this week, but it'd be
It would have been fun.
Yeah, it's helpful if you watch them both.
Both are on Netflix now.
Yes, they are.
It not only would have been fun, it
was fun. Yeah.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking quite a lot about Troll 2. This is kind of like our Room 237 episode. Knowledge of the film in question is helpful but not required. So know that. And also, having seen the documentary, you know quite a lot of what happens in the film. So, mm-hmm.
Well, not really. You get a good refresher course if you've seen it before, I think.
That's probably fair.
If you've never seen it, it is pretty like, what the hell is going on?
I guess we ought to just go around. Who has seen the film? I've seen the film.
I have. I am a new.
I have seen it in bits and pieces.
I mean, you can
basically fast-forwarding to the best of the good parts. I mean, yes. They're all good parts.
Aren't they?
But I am spending probably several hours on YouTube watching my favorite scenes more than once.
Those meaty man parts.
When at my old job, we went through a long period of just, like, anytime somebody was bummed out, pulling up a clip from Troll 2.
Oh, my God!
This movie doesn't do that, which Room 237 did. Rather, this movie examines the cult following this film developed. Now, what's brilliant about the cult following of this particular film is that it was, for a time, until the documentary came out, the bottom-ranked film on IMDb.
For a cool minute.
It was a long time. And so, there you go. Let's just talk about the documentary itself, though, how it succeeds as a documentary. We're doing our thumbs up, thumbs down real quick, and then we'll do some analysis. We're going to talk about movies. We're going to talk about the film study stuff you would do that you'll never, ever see this movie in a film studies course. I can't imagine. I really can't. I mean,
no.
Perhaps. No.
No. What not to do?
Just a maybe a how did this happen?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. But moving on, let's just talk about that. I begin to my left, Mr. Dalton Stewart, if you would, sir.
I liked it a lot. I mean, what more do you want from me?
Well, that's all I asked, I guess.
Yeah, it was good. I liked it.
It worked.
It was charming, you know, in its way. It was really cute to see the people who love Troll 2, and I really did feel bad for Margo, though.
Oh, Margo broke my heart.
Yeah, there was some serious sadness there.
Margo's so sincere.
When Margo says it's complicated, what she means is I'm waiting on my mother to die. And it really hurts. And I felt bad for Dr. Dentist when he had to go to the things and nobody liked Troll 2 or gave a shit about it. My heart hurt for him.
Oh, at the Horror Fest?
Yeah.
And then like a big kind of just general kind of a Comic-Con sort of thing.
Yeah.
In Birmingham, England.
Yeah, and it was just really sad. Because he was clearly like
riding.
Really excited about being a kind of getting to go be a rock star for a little bit.
Yeah,
and he was like his desire to be in entertainment was renewed, and then you know.
He shot.
So I felt bad for him. But I tell you what,
I think you're supposed to.
That guy is so nice that I don't trust him. He seems so cool that there's got to be something
sugary.
Under the
is it sugary?
No, I've known people like George Hardy.
He looks like an awesome guy. That's what I'm saying. He's cool.
And
I want to hang out with them.
Yeah, absolutely. They're really that wonderful, that genuine of human beings that exist. There are very few of them.
I was making a joke, though. I was like, he is so nice, I don't trust him because he seems that genuine,
right.
That earnest of a person. He seems like a heck of a guy, and you can tell why...
The kid from Troll 2.
The kid from Troll 2. I can see why, in the process of making his documentary about his childhood experience, chose to focus on George Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is such an endearing person.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see how... And, you know, in the probably hundreds of hours of film he shot, that was where the internal narrative came from. And I think it's a fascinating tale about the film itself and really about what the film, to me, is mostly about is George Harding's personal experience with the film, more than anything.
I think that's probably fair. Well, Mr. Arthur Gordon, does this one work for you?
It definitely does. It's really fun. I think it's a solid documentary. I like here that we see another style of documentary that we haven't seen yet, because we don't really see our filmmaker as so much. He's there a couple times, I think, but for the most part, he's removed. And we follow George throughout. And so we're kind of got this following the first-person narrative thing, which is kind of a blend of what we're seeing with Cropsey and with probably Room 237 the best,
Major. Well, kind of a cross between the Gonzo style of Cropsey and more traditional
documentary
filmmaking.
So there's another unique blend added to the mix, I'm afraid. You know, I think it does some good stuff. It delves into a very interesting study here about cult fandom and and what makes a movie kind of a cult classic and those kind of things that go in. But I'll take it.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Dustin Sells, what do you think?
Man, this one worked for me, too. I watched, and I mentioned this the last couple weeks, that I had seen Troll 2 on VHS back in the day in that same way where it's just something new on the horror shelves.
Did you have that VHS copy that everyone had that was the little kid up front and the big, way gigantic troll in the back?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. That's what I rented, yeah.
It was that same edition, though?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's precisely what it was.
That makes
me happy. So, I remember not it being so terrible. And my 9-year-old watched it with me, and he does not think at this point that it's quite so terrible. Which kind of makes sense. Because he's close to... I was a little older when I watched it, when this movie came out, when Dalton was but a gleam in his father's eye. And I...
Because Dustin's old.
And... more experienced. Moving on.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around the fact you let your 9-year-old watch Troll 2.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny to
me. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's really nothing. I mean, there's nothing that objectionable in it. It's just...
I mean, the word piss, but...
Yeah.
Meh.
You can't piss on a jelly.
You can't.
Chop up your little nuts and eat them.
I won't allow it.
You won't allow him to piss. Your son's learning valuable lessons.
That's right.
You will not allow him to piss on hospitality.
I will not. That's what those signs mean, brother. So, it really works for me. I did also really identify some of the sadness of some of the characters. Obviously, a general store owner and his mental illness and how that was all tied into his performance. Margot Prey, the sadness of her story is that she views what they did with Troll 2 and that low-budget filmmaking as something akin to doing a Lars von Trier film. She sees herself almost as like a Charlotte Gainsborough.
She compares it to Casablanca.
Yeah, she does.
And without a hint of irony.
No, she seriously doesn't get it. And I find a deep tragedy in that. But I also, I'm just, it's in the same way as you are fascinated watching Troll 2 as a train wreck unfolds, you're watching some of the train wreck of the lives of some of these people that took care of. Also, the complete obliviousness of the Italian filmmakers that they have no idea.
No,
that
not
they have
a clue.
Made such a lousy movie. And you don't get anything.
You understand nothing. You dog of an actor, dog actor.
Because you dare ask the question, why is the movie called Troll 2 when there are no trolls in the film?
When the correct response was, well, our film was called Goblin, and the studio changed it to Troll 2 because they, you know, wanted to make more money.
Right.
Which would be what a normal person would say.
Writing the amazing, you know, success of Troll, or lack thereof. On, let's do some analysis, because this ain't a review show.
Nope.
We're here to think about the movies. We're here to talk about what this has to say in culture and the times in which we live. I turn to you now, Mr. Dulster. What say you, sir?
Well, you know, I think it might have been because I was so engrossed in this film, I really didn't think a lot about it, and just kind of let analysis fall by the wayside this week. I really did. I didn't pull my weight. Sorry, guys. What do you want? The one thing I did think about a lot, though.
Let's look at him in judgment.
The one thing I did think a lot about was, and it's more of a social psychology concept than a sociological concept, which again, as we've covered, I know a bit about, but I'm, you know, hardly my area of expertise, is the idea of rationalization and how we provide meaning to our actions, the things that we've done in our life. And that's really something you see specifically with Margot and Dr. Hardy. Mm-hmm. The two of them have a very differing sensibility about what they did, you know, this summer in 1989.
One being accurate, the other
yes,
being grossly
one
inaccurate.
Delusional is a word that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think that could be a way to hold it.
Yeah.
I'm out of it for a little while. Everybody gets delusions of grandeur.
Well, it breaks my heart. It really does.
It does.
But that was the thing that I really kind of thought about a lot, was just the way in which these people find meaning in their lives as a whole, but specifically these small moments in their life, I thought was really interesting, and how they just kind of rationalize the things that happened to them. One moment in particular that we touched on briefly was when George goes to the different cons that aren't troll-centric, and really the kind of the experience he has and how he rationalizes what happens, and he kind of starts lashing out at the horror fans.
All the gingivitis.
Yeah, because he's very embarrassed, clearly. You know, clearly his feelings were hurt. And that's, you know, you feel bad for the guy. You really do. But that was kind of what I thought about this week. Like I said, didn't pull my weight. Thinking more about the GTGC Awards.
Hey, you know what? That's a big deal. I want to ask you a question, Dalton, though.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe, you know, just to kind of have some more thoughts about just what's going on in the film. George Hardy is a bad actor in Troll 2. Are we agreed?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So, my question is this. The performance George Hardy gives in Best Worst Movie is endearing,
mm-hmm.
meaningful,
yeah.
and believable.
Okay.
Is he a bad actor?
I mean, that is to presume that the person we see in Best Worst Movie is not the real George Hardy, I guess, is what we're saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's part of what acting is to pretend the camera's not there, right?
Yeah. So if we're assuming that George Hardy is, you know, putting on some sort of show for the cameras in Best Worst Movie, then absolutely, he's the best actor that ever lived.
I think George Hardy's playing George Hardy, but Jack Nicholson plays Jack Nicholson.
Fair enough. I mean, and I think George might be playing up a little bit of his gregariousness, you know, for the camera.
Yeah.
Well, Jack's probably not quite as crazy as the Joker.
Probably not. Although, you know, when you watch a Lakers game, there he is.
Wait till they get a load of me.
All right, thank you, Dalton. I appreciate that. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what analysis bring you?
Sweet Jeebus. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about cult fandom. And so
that's the thing, isn't it?
Relevant here, I believe. Best Worst Movie takes a look at a very interesting phenomenon in cult fandom. Something that's gone on for years, different movies, you know, different little things have these little followings, and it happens. It does a very good job of exploring this revival of the film and letting us into discovery of how this has blown up and how the stars of the film have experienced and interacted with it.
Right.
Cult cinema is a very interesting topic because it draws this line in the sand against classics of cinema, quote unquote, of, you know, Ben-Hur, High Noon, Stagecoach, Vertigo, these classic films that we were familiar with. And also,
then there's this cult, right, that thinks that this movie is a classic. I have a question.
Yes.
Are we allowed to take seriously these people that talk about this cinematic masterpiece that George Harding may be a fine dentist, but I respect him as an actor?
I think these people...
They are sincere, I think.
I think a lot of them are being tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
I think when they say Troll 2 is one of the finest things ever produced, they are fully aware that on every objective level, it is a steaming pile of refuse. But at the same time, there is something magical and endearing about how truly, deeply awful the film Troll 2 was.
Yeah.
The film Troll 2 is.
I think Dalton's hit the point. I concur. But it also draws a line in the sand against these movies that studios try to force on us to become classics or cult classics, such as
Oscar bait.
Well, there's that, but also blockbusters, R.I.P.D., which flopped.
Whoa.
John Carter of Mars, The Lone Ranger, these films in the last year that have
greatest film of 2013
terribly flopped. Hey, Quentin Tarantino put it on his top 10 list.
The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger.
He always has the weirdest top 10.
No, I really like The Lone Ranger, but I'll talk about that some of the time.
Seriously.
I've been interested in checking it out. Regardless.
No interest. Continue.
Typically, these movies fail to do well financially and are often neglected upon their release. And then they tend to find life on home video and through word of mouth. And we see this in Best Worst Movie, as some of the fans talk about how they just spread the word about the film to their friends, and those friends told friends, and so on. And then we had the gospel of Troll 2 as converts were made, and the word spread throughout the land. When we did our episode on The Crow, I talked about cult cinema and some of the markers about what makes a cult film, things such as unknown or less recognizable players, which Troll 2 is full of, the breaching of social taboos, and in here, Troll 2 is dealing with vegetarianism, which in middle America, 1990s, our world is a little taboo.
Those kids are weird. That's
what you mean,
in the 90s.
You don't eat meat? What kind of weirdo are you?
How do you live?
You hippie?
Weird is a much nicer word than was probably the word
thrown around.
Actually being thrown around.
I'm not quoting any of my family right now.
Yeah.
And there's also this image of excess, and here we see that there's an excess of foods. A lot of times there's excess of violence in a way, especially when the kids are being eaten. But the question of exploration for Best Worst Movie is what creates this cult fandom. Sure, the movie does play rather comically and it makes people laugh. And that idea of showing someone else the secret disaster does play to our human nature, I feel. When you're with your friends and you see a bad wreck or something embarrassing happening to someone, don't you usually quickly point it out? But what really draws people to a film like Troll 2? In his essay, British Cult Cinema, Justin Smith says that certain kinds of cultural texts, ones whose unfinished structure allows remarkable creative agency and psychic investment on the part of the viewer, can be used to displace shared subjective anxieties, end quote, and that, quote, psychic disposition as well as general cultural factors draw certain individuals to cult films as transitional objects in the process of subjective self-recognition with which we are all engaged, end quote. This begins to lead us in an interesting direction. The two vocabulary terms of interest here are psychic disposition and transitional objects.
I was hoping you would define this.
The psychic disposition, as mentioned by Carl Jung, exists in the preconscious and it enables man to react in a human manner.
We just broke down with some Carl Jung on you in Best Worst Movie and Troll 2. That's right, dear listener. We're bringing the knowledge. Go on, Arthur.
Whereas a transitional object is believed to be any item that allows for a child to make the necessary shift from oral relationship with the mother to genuine object relationships.
That'd be Lacan. Moving on.
This is an interesting perspective of the role of cult films. These icons serve a purpose of identification for us. We see these movies with great knowledge and understanding of their failures. We look at films such as Troll 2 or Plan 9 from Outer Space or Pluto Nash. And we see movies that have failed miserably.
I'm sorry, he said Pluto Nash.
Well played, sir.
But we have still seen these failures find a new home and in doing so a new purpose. Seeing these films succeed allows us to see ourselves as successes. It gives us hope that we can serve a purpose, just not in the way that we intended. This exists on many levels, and becoming a cult icon, not only has the film succeeded, but so has the director, the writer, the actor, and the crew. Again, not in the way they intended, which is much of the tragedy here for our Italian filmmakers.
Nor in the way they realized.
Oh, Claudio.
But in some way, their work has found an audience and a way to inspire that audience, which I would believe to be their initial goal. And that is why these cult phenomenons spread, because we see it and then we share it with our friends, people who share similar hopes, desires, and fears with us. And then they're able to share it, and then those people share it. And on a basic level, we find enjoyment and camaraderie in the sharing of the material. But on a subconscious level, it may be safe to argue that the movie becomes the great equalizer, reducing audiences to a similar mental state and showing our true equality as basic human beings.
You know, and I think that's really crucial, Arthur, is that the point of a cult movie is that it's shared.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what makes it work.
Oh, yes. It is about that community, about that that bonding experience, a connection to the greater human struggle. I mean, it's a very lofty thing to put into words, but when you break it down, you realize it is what it's all about.
I'll give two shout-outs. Maggie and Daniel, you remember how we used to always quote The Princess Bride, Maggie, and City Slickers, Daniel? It became a cult film for us. I mean, that's really what it was, right?
Arthur, I just want to say I'm really glad you picked up the slack for me this evening, because that was lovely.
You know, it happens.
Well played, sir.
Well, Dustin, what do you think?
I want to examine the theoretical theory that is based in this film, is this idea that films are things that are a basis of criticism, that you can objectively examine a film and determine its value.
Mm-hmm.
That is a fundamental aspect of film criticism that we don't actually do on the show. This is an analysis show,
yes.
Not a review show. What I want to analyze right now is that process of review in films.
The idea that there can be an ultimate, objective way of looking at a film's quality, right?
But yeah, or something as simply as arbitrary as thumbs up,
thumbs down,
thumbs down, or
shelf or trash,
a handful of stars, whatever or lack thereof. And that there is something going on in movies. Now, when we evaluate film, we find that there are these aspects of film that can be done well. There are certain tastes in acting. There are certain understandings of what's good and what's bad. And again, but those things themselves, they have an aesthetic, they have a time, they have a place, they have a style. I'm thinking right now, Mary Pickford and Clara Bow and Jean Harlow, whom I love. But if they were doing what they do in that silent movie era right now, in a 21st century film, everyone would probably cast them in the Troll 2 Part 2 prequel. Ouch. But that's probably the kind of place where that sort of performance would belong.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like Marlon Brando mumbling his lines, or James Dean, or later on Robert De Niro, and this realism and thoughtfulness would have been junk in the 20s. Right?
Yes. I thought you were saying they're junk now. I was like, no, those performances are still amazing.
No, I love them. Because I am in the rhythm aesthetic.
That
right now.
The intensity of, you know, James Dean in something like Rebel Without a Cause is, what the hell is this? In, you know, 1927.
Mm-hmm. Or the originator of that method sort of acting, Marlon Brando on the Waterfront.
Yeah, certainly.
And no one saw that sort of thing coming. And of course, it really fed into the spirit of the times. And so you can evaluate that. You can evaluate direction and the choices of cuts or lack of choices in cuts. For instance, Claudio / Draco / I don't remember, John Doe, whatever his names are.
How many?
There's at least six.
He's been credited under six different names.
IMDb has at least six aliases. Mm-hmm.
Not a good sign.
It's not good.
Not a good sign.
It means you're bad.
Yeah.
Moving on.
He's directed 27 films in English. I don't know if you're aware of that. That's what he said. I don't know if that's a fact.
Sorry, my heart hurt. I had to come back. There is this scene, famous scene, where it says, you see these signs? You know what they mean?
Hospitality.
Hospitality, right. That scene going down the hallway. You know what that scene needs? Some cuts.
Yeah.
That's not a long take opportunity. That is not Ray Liotta walking into the club through the kitchen and on out and following the table and the caterers. That's not a Scorsese moment.
Yeah.
You know what it is? It's a dude carrying a kid down the hallway and we need to get down to business. And apparently he looks like he's about to get down to business, but we're not going to talk about it right now. That is not a long take opportunity.
No, not at all.
That is an absolute failure in direction. We could address the issue of score, but it hurts my soul to think about it. It's bad. And of course, choreography also plays a role because there is a dance scene.
Oh, God.
An ad-lib dance scene.
Oh, God. Oh, God. The horror. The horror.
See last week's episode.
The finger glasses.
They're amazing. What I want to say is this. There are a lot of objective levels in which this film does not work, but that really does begin to raise the question of film criticism and the question of dialogue in film, because as we begin to look at film, we begin to realize that there are different, not only times and periods and aesthetics and tastes where Scorsese becomes that which is good as opposed to, say, a Orson Welles or a Sergei Eisenstein or wherever else we want to go, where we love the performances of a Marlon Brando versus, let's say, a Charlie Chaplin. As we begin to see those things transition and change, there's also these simple taste differences where Gene Siskel says one thing and Roger Ebert says quite yet another.
Sir, what immediately came to mind we were talking about was Billy Wilder and his contemporaries and the dialogue of their films, which are very distinct, very rat-a-tat fast, a very specific way of speaking that you don't hear in film anymore. And I don't know. I think it's probably because nobody ever spoke that way.
Well, it's like Tarantino.
Yeah. Well, a great example. Very perfect example, actually.
It's perfectly cool and awesome is the way you wished you talked in the 50s versus the way that you wished you talked in the mid-90s to the 2000-aughts and beyond.
But that was what that made me think of when you're kind of rattling off that list of kind of the evolution of what is, quote, good, what is, quote, standard in a film.
But there's yet another wrinkle to this, is this idea of taste.
Yes.
And that's really what Best Worst Movie is driving at, this idea of taste, where you can appreciate what Susan Sontag calls camp. In an essay that creates the term for us, is this idea that we can appreciate that which is bad because of a certain self-reflexivity and self-awareness, where we can appreciate different sorts of things. Famously, the nearly universally lauded masterpiece of David Lynch is Blue Velvet, or perhaps Mulholland Drive, and Roger Ebert hates, not only hated, hates.
Still actively
in his grave, hates Blue Velvet. To the
not a fan of it.
Not a fan. And yet, it is one of those lauded pieces. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the best worst movie.
Well,
we're talking about an issue of taste and that which is enjoyable. Because the thing is people who really like movies really genuinely like the things they want to watch. Those people who are arguing for these canons of film, which really becomes the heart of this show, and says Casablanca is one of the greats, Citizen Kane is one of the greats, they genuinely want to watch that. The fact of the matter is, however, many people who are students of film or just lovers of film would be sat before Citizen Kane and go, this is junk. Not because they hate movies from 1941, because you could put that same crowd in front of another 1941 film and they say, man, I love me some James Cagney. Give me some more of that.
James Cagney.
Right? So, it comes down to this sort of individual personal taste. And when we're talking about criticism, and I make a distinction between criticism and analysis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I think we've talked about that on the show a little bit, but it is an important distinction to make.
And I think this film is talking about this discussion of criticism as to whether it works, whether it doesn't work. That's why we do it so quickly on the show, and we get through it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we want to get to know our biases. Because in the end, the analysis is really something that is a different animal altogether. We're talking about what a thing means. And what I'm talking about when I'm talking about what the movie, best worst movie, means is that it is an exercise in taste. It is an exercise in criticism. And it asks and begs the question, what is worth your time? Because that is fundamentally what film criticism seeks to do, what critics seek to do when they write for Entertainment Weekly or the Roundtable Review or other excellent sources on the interwebs.
Thank you.
Is let you know.
Is to let you know whether or not this film is worth your time. And this film is about a group of people who are vehemently advocating that Troll 2 is completely worth your time. Furthermore, I wish to argue they're right.
I would agree.
Troll 2 is totally worth your time.
Para ejemplo, as we discussed last week, I'm quite excited about the film 47 Ronin. I haven't looked at any reviews for them. I imagine they're less than stellar. You know what I still want to see?
47.
You're damn right.
Absolutely, because it looks like it's going to be loads of fun and it's up in your wheelhouse.
I like Kung Fu.
And really, that comes down to this nature of discourse. And that's what this movie's about. And that's really what IMDb is about, which is the fundamental creator of the circumstance in which this movie would be filmed, is that human beings are having this discourse, this conversation about this movie, and it got ranked all the way at the bottom. There are so many people who said, wait a minute. Yeah, there are these objective ways in which you start talking about what a film is, excellent or otherwise. But then you have to think about what it is as an experience. What it is as something to look at and time well spent whilst eating popcorn. And when one does so, does one, if I can continue to use this sort of magisterial third person.
Yeah, you're really rocking it right now. Go on.
When one does so, what does one experience? One experiences a ton of fun. And that makes it worth the time.
Well said, Mr. Sells.
Very well.
All right, gentlemen. Well, I think that's some fun analysis about this movie, about yet another movie. Let's do what we always do, though. Shall we shelf best worst movie, or shall we trash it? I ask you, Mr. Arthur Gordon.
I was going to initially say no. It was going to be a stream it or put it on your fridge shelf. But once I heard rumor of this Blu-ray combo of Troll 2 and Best Worst Movie, I'd say put it on your shelf. Because there is some double feature gold there.
Certainly.
I say, else, you're going to watch this with some of my my guilty pleasure bad movies. Mighty Ducks 3. Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
The movie.
The movie. The original movie. None of this Turbo crap.
Oh, no. The hell is Turbo?
And finally, Dalton's favorite movie, Teen Wolf.
Hot dog.
Those are my picks, guys. Dalton, what do you think?
You know what, Arthur? I'm going to agree with you. That this is a film that belongs on the shelf. I think it promotes a really interesting conversation that is certainly worth having. I will go ahead and do what Arthur did instead of what I was going to do, which was say you should watch some other cult films. And obviously, you should watch Troll 2. You should maybe check out Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, a film that is name-checked in Best Worst Movie. Maybe even watch Room 237 again if you did, or for the first time in conjunction with this. Much like Arthur, I feel the need to talk about some of my guilty pleasures. The Underworld film franchise. I didn't see the latest one, but the first two are super cool, guys. Guys are super cool.
Are they good? Maybe not.
No, they're terrible, but they're super cool. The Resident Evil movies, also super cool.
Yeah, I like them.
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter from a couple years ago. Guys, Abraham Lincoln does kung fu with a wood axe.
My mom's
and fights vampires.
My mom's thoughts on that was we watched Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter in the same week.
Bitch and double feature.
And she would opt to watch a Vampire Hunter again.
And so obviously, the only things coming to mind right now are newer releases. But I mean, you know, these are things that basically every Bruce Lee movie. Just watch them all right now. Go. Guess what? Most of them aren't very good.
But they're awesome.
They're so freaking cool. Oh, my God. Really, you know, most kung fu movies actually fit into this category. But these are the things that came to mind when Arthur was doing his spiel just now, and I felt the need to share. Mr. Sells, shovel trash, Elser instead.
What I'm going to say is the same thing everyone else has said. We have a universality. We have an agreement. We have a concord consensus that this is a shelfable movie. Dear listener, we are probably betting on you having not seen this movie upon you listening to this episode. That is how strong our recommendation is that you should see Best Worst Movie. And maybe go ahead and venture out and get adventurous.
It really is deeply fascinating.
And see Troll 2.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
It's fun to
definitely watch Troll 2.
It's so good. So it's definitely shelfable. Santa has yet to come to my house in some ways. By all means, contact us via social media and send them out. What else, or instead, in this case, it would obviously be an else. I'm going to say, For the Love of the Movies, which is a great documentary currently streaming on the Flix of Nets, which examines the history of movie criticism, as I discussed just a few moments ago, in Hollywood, in America. So we have the whole Pauline Kael, Andy Serkis controversy, and we have the whole rise of the great Roger Ebert,
man,
and many other things.
Why did we not watch that for this marathon?
Because it did not come out streaming until last week.
That's
what
why.
Was it?
It's called For the Love of the Movies. You need to see it, dear listener. It's a lot of fun. That is one of my recommendations. Obviously, I concur with everything that's said in cult film. And I want to say this. Cult film is some of those things that you just love to quote. And I want to say this. Back to the Future, totally a blockbuster, totally a cult film.
Absolutely.
I want to say, Princess Bride made a lot of money on VHS. Totally a cult film. There's a lot of that great...
Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a critically lauded film. Totally a cult film.
Absolutely.
Hands down.
See some of those great classics, and then speak in a very highly pitched falsetto voice British accent to your heart's content.
It's a lot of fun.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left. Yes, I have. Look, just a flesh wound.
So let's talk about how you can perhaps find our addresses to send us gifts, or just continue the conversation, or connect to some of the articles and artwork that we try to connect you all to via the great internet bounty that is social media. Mr. Arthur Gordon, could you speak to us about any of those social mediums?
Yes, Dustin. You can find us on Facebook.com / Good Trash Genrecast. And we do have some feedback coming in from the Facey Facebook. Brigham Cole had to correct us, informing us of the 5 stages of grief, which we did not fully put out. And so
we
said there are like 20 of them.
Initially. By we mean Caleb.
Yes. That's fair. Anyway, he says there, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance in that order. Randall Bays tells us that his, for lack of a better term, favorite Holocaust films are The Boy in the Striped Pajamas and the documentary Paragraph 175. And then I asked about other just historical-based films, since we were talking about historiography. And Shane Arrington listed a few, saying Braveheart, Schindler's List, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Tombstone and Full Metal Jacket, while giving a shout-out to all of Kubrick and Scorsese's historical films. And then in regards to Troll 2, Marcus Mallard and Anson Holt both chime in saying that Troll 2 is a personal favorite of theirs. So we got some more feedback here. We got some feedback this week on different topics. We've got a couple of new voices chiming in this week. So some good stuff over on Facebook.
We appreciate it. We have a more traditional means of social media as well, don't we?
Oh, yes. For those of you who are not on any of the social medias of those that we are on, you can email us, that is a thing still, at goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com.
Thank you, Arthur, and I love hearing that feedback. Mr. Donald Stewart, is there yet another medium available?
There's no Facebook on the Good Trash Genrecast. Facebook is the devil's social media. Email? Gah! Gah! Email! Gah! Have some nice nilbog Twitter. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find the Good
this
Trash...
This is that goblin backwards.
Shh. Speak nothing. I have no idea where I was when I was filming that. That poor man. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find the Good Trash Genrecast on Twitter @good_trash.
Also, in addition, you may find us all at goodtrashgenrecast.tumblr.com. And there you will not find necessarily articles, although sometimes there's an article, but the occasional bit of artwork.
Yes, some really cool stuff,
and
usually.
Whatnot, and occasionally jokes involving Ryan Gosling saying, hey girl, sort of statements involving film theory. That's right. Because that's how we rock it.
Well, I guess it's time to wrap this year up.
It really is. And so we're going to give the GTGC Awards for the first time ever. Now, let's just talk a little history of the show. This Good Trash Genrecast was originally birthed out of the UCO Film Society.
In August of 2012.
and it was an outgrowth thereof. We had a great, much more variety in hosting and whatnot for the show. There was a hiatus around February because there was a transition semester, and all those UCO films aside, UCO being the University of Central Oklahoma.
For those of you not in the know.
Film Society members and their schedules as far as their classes and whatnot and recording became something somewhat difficult. And so there was a great hiatus between about February-ish of 2013 till June.
Mid-May. I believe when we reconvened.
Okay. And so we are now at our 51st episode. We've really been at this for a little over a year now. But we're right at the cusp of one year.
A full year's worth of one episodes a week.
If you are doing the back catalog thing and trying to catch up. And so we're going to look at the year 2013, which is around 30-ish episodes.
Now, this is, to be clear, movies we discussed on the podcast in 2013, not films that were released theatrically in 2013.
Because this is not a review show. You know what review shows do? They do that. You know what we're going to do? Not that.
We're going to do the first annual GTGC Awards.
That's right, dear listener. We're going to give an award. We're going to put the platinum shelf out. And we're going to say this film deserves to be in the film studies, enshrined in the high halls of film and theory and all of that, which is good and wonderful. And we're also going to lay down the Hebrew hammer on that which deserves to be destroyed.
So I guess I'll go ahead and kick this off. We'll work our way from the bottom of our list of awards to the platinum shelf. The film that is so good, it might be too good for the show, and it might need to actually be discussed in a film studies course. We'll start at the bottom.
Platinum Shelf Awards.
Ladies and gentlemen, or rather, gentlemen and gentlemen, let's talk about our favorite...
Well, the dear listener might have a different...
Well, I was talking to you guys.
Oh, hi.
You two specifically. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners...
How you doing?
How you doing? Gentleman and gentleman co-host. I'm feeling good. We're going to talk first about our favorite discovery. This is a film that we saw for the first time because we were assigned to watch it for the Good Trash Genre Cast. Start to my far right, Arthur Gordon, what do you think?
I think my discovery is a close one, but I'm going to have to go, I believe, with Compliance.
Good pick.
Which I think is just a fascinating film. It's hard to watch. Mm-hmm. That was the topic of that show, that episode in particular. But it is fascinating. I think it's an important film for people to see. And I am really happy that it's one of the movies we picked this year.
You're welcome, because I picked it.
Well, thank you. Thank
Dustin
you very much.
Sells, what would you say is your favorite discovery this year?
Well, you know, I love that we discussed dialogue and its shifting nature and how it was a certain way in the 50s, specifically in the Billy Wilder era, mm-hmm. versus the Tarantino cool that we experience now, or perhaps the Kevin Smith cool. More on that later.
Well, and even the realism of the 70s. We talked a little bit about the kind of Dog Day Afternoon, this very kind of staccato way. It's different. It's still, you can kind of see it transitioning between those two eras. I don't even know how to put it into words.
And there is a film that we looked at in 2013 that is this great mashup of that Billy Wilder dialogue in a contemporary, no, nay, not contemporary, futuristic setting, in which Guy Pearce so smugly delivers all of these amazing lines in a movie called Lockout.
Our very first episode of 2013.
Absolutely. And it is tons of fun. That is my great discovery. Perhaps guilty pleasure as well. That movie is amazing. And it's so much fun because of not only the dialogue itself, but Guy Pearson's delivery thereof.
Absolutely fair.
Mr. Dalton Stewart, what is your great discovery?
It's Pontypool, guys.
Yeah, buddy.
Oh, man, I love Pontypool.
You're welcome.
And I have Dustin Sells to thank for that. Pontypool is a film that just really blew my hair back. I'm so glad we watched it. And I think about it all the time. I still think about that film. Like, the other day I was thinking about it and how much I like that film and how deeply fascinating I find that film. On a truly personal level, on a truly, like, important level. I think it is very closely approaches digging its way out of the realm of good trash. Because I think it is that good of a film.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I'm a fan.
Well, we'll go ahead and keep on moving then, and we're going to do our next award, which is Best Show of 2013. And this is just on your personal opinion, as one of the hosts of this show, what do you think is one of the best shows we did this year? A great jumping in point for our listeners. We'll start with you, Dustin Sells. What do you think?
I think our best show this year was the Maniac Show. Strangely enough, we really kind of hit this high point in our ability to discuss film and to give analysis, and it really was, we really got the energy and the flow back. I think our entire Shocktober was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I like Maniac okay as a film. I have seen it since that show. It's not the best show, best particular movie that we looked at, but I really liked what we brought to the table looking at that particular show, because we really did formalism, we really did sociology, we really did this sort of theoretical analysis of the film, and I really did that show. So, dear listener, if you're going back in the back catalog and you're trying to decide what you want to look at, Dustin's recommendation is Maniac. But I'm not the only one making recommendations. Arthur, what do you think? What's our best show at 2013?
You know what? I'm going to go a little deeper in as well, and I'm going to say the Room 237 episode in which we discussed the documentary of the same title.
You mean the Ninth Ring of Hell, in which I had to edit that jumbled mess?
I apologize for
God.
That.
But, listener, just so you know, that episode, I think, on iTunes, on our Podbean site, runs at like an hour and 20 minutes, right?
Yeah.
We recorded for an hour and 45, an hour and 50 minutes, probably.
Yeah. It was a while.
Yeah, it got real. It got out of hand for a cool minute.
But I have to say, that was one of our shows. We had a lot of energy. I thought we all were on our A game, and which was really impressive, because this transition into documentary really could have thrown us all for a loop. But I think we all did a good job in just picking up and continuing strong. And we kind of came off a little 2-week hiatus, I think, so there's a lot of energy to come back into that. Dalton? What would you say is the best show of the year?
You know, I thought about this for a little bit. I want to give an honorable mention to our Ghostbusters show. Because we all, like, went out of our way to actually cite things that smart people had said in the past. And because it's got the distinction of being one of the few episodes my mother's listened to. And I got to talk to her.
And I love you, Mother.
And I had to explain to my mother what the meaning behind a Freudian reading of Ghostbusters was, and I had to explain things about film analysis to her. That was interesting.
And repression.
And I feel like we were all really,
lots of repression.
And release. Welcome. You said it, not me, bud. But I feel like we were all really on point on that episode. But I'm going to go ahead and go to kind of a cheat, and I'm going to say our television marathon. I think that was a really great month of episodes that we really, in particular, the giant, the pilot, I don't know what we even call that, the pilot extravaganza, where we did three pilots one pilot for three different shows. That was a lot of fun. We talked about Space, Jericho, and American Horror Story on that episode, and it was a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed that marathon as a whole, and I think a really, granted, not about film at all, but a good jumping in point for this show.
Yeah.
You get to see us doing something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on now to The Hebrew Hammer.
Worst movie of the year.
The film that makes your blood boil, gentlemen. The film that before you'd watch it again, you'd sooner get a root canal while getting your toenails removed. We're going to drop The Hebrew Hammer on a film, and we will start to my right. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what film do you want to drop The Hebrew Hammer on?
Well, there haven't been a lot of movies that I've really, disliked or hated with fervor this year. Some may remember me not really being too amused by Maniac.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one movie that I am going to drop the hammer on that I loathe, that I thought was a waste of my time and energy to put any effort into watching. And I would much rather have a root canal while having my toenails removed before
It's hard to say, I know.
It is. Before watching it again, and that is John Dies at the End.
Wow.
The utter garbage from this year.
Wow. I've rewatched it twice since the show.
You disliked it that much?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Terrible
film. That door cannot be opened.
Well, we'll go ahead and move down the line close from me. Mr. Dustin Sells, what film do you want to drop the Hebrew Hammer on?
Guys, I tried drinking it. I tried so much. I tried to love it. I tried to give it a chance because that's what the show is about. I could watch The Rock. I could watch Armageddon. I could watch frickin' Transformers again. But Bad Boys 2 was a drain on my soul.
The single most nihilistic film we've ever watched on the show.
Oh my goodness.
And guys, we did a lot of movies from the late 90s on our first couple of months.
And it wasn't even fun. It was, I hate Peter Pan and Bad Boys 2.
Fair enough.
Mr. Dalton Stewart, where would you like to drop the Hebrew hammer upon our heads?
Oh, Lord. Well, I thought about this for a moment, and I almost said Beverly Hills Cop 2. Or not.
What?
Sorry, I almost said Beverly Hills Cop, but that was because I liked it less than I thought I would. That was more of a disappointment than an out-and-out discontent.
That is a different animal.
And I almost went with Room 237 because it was so obnoxious and had its head so squarely planted in its haunches. But no, there is but one film that I never wanted to see again for the rest of my life that I had to watch again for this stupid podcast because of Arthur freaking Gordon, and that is teen racist ass Michael J. Fox Wolf. I hate that movie. I hate that movie. God, oh God, I hate that movie.
All I have to say is that the analysis of that film that Mr. Dalton Stewart offered makes that film so worth your time.
And once again, I do have to give credit where credit is due to Crack.com, who helped me see that analysis, and I picked it up and ran with it.
And it's totally there, and it is totally worth your time, and it is totally a very, very bad movie. Yeah, absolutely it is.
Well, we'll move on to the second to last award, and that is the Best Worst Movie Award. This is a film that is not great. It is objectively maybe kind of bad, much like Troll 2, but a film that spoke to you on a personal level, and it just is something that stuck with you. It doesn't have to be a film that was newly discovered this year on, you know, from watching it for an episode we were going to record. But just a film that you've watched this year for the show that you thought, that's not very good, but I like it. So we'll start with you once again, Mr. Arthur Gordon. What is your best worst movie of GTGC's 2013?
You know, I was really close to saying Teen Wolf. Mm-hmm. But I think that's going to be my honorable mention.
Okay.
I am going to go with a movie that we've already discussed a little bit tonight. And that is Lockout.
Okay.
Yeah,
I kind of thought you were going to say Bad Boys 2.
Oh, no, no, no. Never. Never.
Thought you were drinking the Beta-Rate.
I drank it, but I didn't have to like it. There were better movies watched that week, namely Pain and Gain. Not by much. Regardless, I'm going to say Lockout
with
Guy Pearce, which is got some rough spots in it, but I think it brings the satire well enough to help it, you know, get it maintain a comeback and score in my heart.
Totally fair. Dustin Sells, what was your best worst movie?
This movie I don't think is good. I don't think it really says a lot. I mean, we did analysis to it, mm-hmm. and there were things that we could discuss, and there are disturbing things in American society that are worthy of our consideration that are being raised, but in the end, it's really kind of a train wreck.
Dustin,
the performance is given by a singular body part.
Can I guess what it is?
I think perhaps it might be obvious, but go right ahead.
Is it God Bless America?
Negative. Ghost
is it Road. Maniac?
Negative.
Single Body Part.
Single Body Part. Okay, you lost me there.
I'm talking about Dread.
Oh, shit.
Dread is tons of fun, but it's not good.
I'm so glad I converted you, because I was afraid you were going to say Dread when you were going on that rant before dropping the Hebrew hammer on Bad Boys 2.
Oh, no.
I thought it was Dread for a second.
No, Dread's fun. It's a fun watch.
I convinced him it was good.
There is a certain joy in Dread that is completely missing from Bad Boys 2, where Michael Bay is realizing, I just want to get paid. And I feel a lot of that.
But there's heart.
There's some sort of heart to...
There's chins and hearts to be had.
and the mess... video game plotted mess that is Dread, where the big boss is at the top level. I'm just saying.
Oh, you're not wrong.
But it really is, in that sense, very much a fun experience, and one I would do again. Dalton Stewart, what is your best worst movie of 2013?
Well, I'll give an honorable mention to one that I thought you might have been picking for your best worst movie, and that is Maniac, a film shot from one point of view. A film that, as we said, is not great, but inspired such a really thoughtful and, I dare say, profound conversation on this show. It was one of, as the gentleman said, it's one of our better episodes this year. I had a lot of fun that episode. I was really juiced. I was just excited to be with you guys that week. And I think we really brought our A game, and it was inspired by the film Maniac. And I think we owe it that service. But my pick goes to a film that Arthur hated, and that's John Dies at the End.
Yeah, man.
That's my best worst movie. It's because it's objectively got a lot of problems, but man, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in that film.
It was fun.
It is a blast. I liked it a lot. And I think it most squarely fits the mission statement of this show, to dig underneath the dirt of the good trash. Well,
that's right.
What?
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, fans of all ages, probably don't let your kids listen to this show. I get a little salty sometimes. But it's that time to give away the final golden statue. We made you wait 3 hours of pageantry. We made you look at Angelina Jolie's stupid dress. It's
Arthur
time.
Did a musical number.
It was weird and kind of anti-Semitic.
And hot.
Very sensual. Neil Patrick Harris showed up. Natalie Portman and Anne Hathaway were there. It was a thing. Emmys were had. Awards were given. Cocaine was done. It's time for the final award of the night. The Platinum Shelf. The film that's so good, not only do you want to put it on your shelf, you want to put it in a shrine and put that shrine on your shelf. A film so good, so profoundly beautiful, it might be too good for this show. It might actually belong in a film studies course. Start with you, Mr. Arthur Gordon. What belongs on your Platinum Shelf this year?
Well, it was a close toss-up. And I was really close to put End of Watch on there because I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a
good,
solid film.
It really is.
And that may be one of my favorite movies we watched this year. But I'm going to have to go with Into the Wild.
Good pick.
And, if people were asking what of the movies we've seen this year, what would I suggest they watch that I think they should watch? I think Into the Wild is a very good film. I think it's a powerful film. I think it's important. And a pedagogical stance, especially if you want to study film and literature. I think there's a lot going on there. And so for that, I'm going to put Into the Wild on the Platinum Shelf.
I would also like to give just a behind-the-scenes view behind the curtain. Into the Wild began a series of cut moments in this show in which the gentleman at this table and Mr. Caleb Masters, who is now missing, sang at me often with the voice of,
"Dear, dear, Brandy Candy."
I bet you didn't know we had Eddie Vedder in the studio tonight.
Of my favorite bands. lead singer.
Jeremy Sheridan Sheriff in Clash.
You can see why he cuts it every week.
Only have yourself to blame.
I like that one.
It's not like I'm not going to cut it this week, too.
You shouldn't. Let the people know. Oh. Give them that inside baseball.
The truth is out there.
And so, 2 weeks ago, there was a Pearl Jam drop. That's my way of sticking a thumb back in these gentlemen's eyes for all of that. But that began an ongoing joke, which has provided much enjoyment to us all. And I just wanted to go ahead and share that moment with you all upon the mention of Into the Wild. Mr. Donald Stewart, where is your shelves? What is your Platinum Shelf pick for 2013?
Well, I do want to give an honorable mention as to Arthur's pick, Into the Wild. I think it's a great pick, Arthur. It's a film that I really enjoyed. The more I thought about it, the more I liked it after we recorded that show. And I thought a little bit about this, and I kind of hem and hawed and there were things to be said. Dread, I really liked. I mean, it was on my top 10 of 2012. I think it's that good of a good trash film. But I went to one film, and there's a reason when we ended our hiatus, we started with this film. Because it is the epitome of good trash. It is fantastic trash. It's still trash, mind you. Mm-hmm. But it is golden trash.
Yeah, it is.
That is so rich in material and so has such a depth of heart and a depth of character and a depth of theme that you can dig your teeth into it for weeks. And also, it's freaking hilarious. And that's Cabin in the Woods.
Good pick.
When we finally were able to get back together and said, we're going to keep doing this show, there was no question about what film we would kick the show back off with.
And it truly is on the shelf of all three of your hosts tonight. That movie's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yep.
Love it. Love it to pieces. And I think that's what makes it a prime entry in the Platinum Shelf. Because it should be discussed in a film studies course. Because the whole of horror film history, I think, leads us to Cabin in the Woods. And I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I say that. Dustin Sells.
I think you're totally onto something there, Dalton. But I don't think that... I didn't pick that film. And that film, nay, did not even make honorable mention. I would mention Compliance.
Mm-hmm.
I would mention Days of Heaven because, well...
I thought about putting Compliance on my... both on my Platinum Shelf and on my my favorite discovery of the year.
And I would even mention Imaginary Witness. So those are part of the nominees, you know. We were giving that drum roll and all of that moment of
so Platinum
suspense.
Shelf baity.
But the Platinum Shelf for me is Maniac. I think that movie is brilliant.
For the same reasons it's an honorable mention for my best worst movie? Or what are you doing here?
I think that movie is absolutely brilliant in some of the same ways that Cabin in the Woods is brilliant. But in addition to that, which is amazingly intertextual, conversational, dialogical, dialectical with the tradition of Hollywood horror film, is also stylistically fantastic. Not only in the sort of gimmicky use of first-person photography, but the very aesthetic itself, the way that the colors themselves are rendered, and the psychological depths. I mean, if you want to have an examination of Lacan's mirror stage, I mean, for crying out loud, plus all those other amazing psychoanalytical thoughts, plus all these other amazing ramifications as far as sociology of violence and of women, and the discussion of remakes, as this film itself is a remake, I find this movie to be truly, truly valuable as a film. And not only that, there is also the intertextuality outside of film brought back inside film with that use of Goodbye Horses, which is used in Silence of the Lambs, which is a thing itself before either one of those movies existed, and has some things to say as well.
I really like your reasons, Dustin, and I think we've all, I know you and I both think Arthur might have as well, touched on why that episode stands out. Even though we didn't all really love the film, Arthur didn't care for
it
much at all. Obviously, you and I kind of liked it okay. And it's interesting to me that this is where we ended up, though, that that was your pick.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the conversation that it creates. Not because mm-hmm. you particularly enjoyed the film.
Not particularly. It's not my favorite movie.
But I like your reasons for picking it.
I think it belongs in the Platinum Shelf.
As an important piece of good trash.
Absolutely. I mean, dare I say it, relegates itself to that place of art.
Yeah.
I think it deserves there. And I think the picks that you guys have given as well also suggest the possibility that this may be better than just trash.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's part of what we're trying to do here with this show.
Well, that's it, guys. We just wrapped what is the closest we had to a full year of episodes so far in the history of this show.
We're going to try to go through 52 episodes in 52 weeks next year.
We're hoping.
In fact, it may be 52, because, dear listener, we got a surprise for y'all. I'm going to go ahead and announce this.
Do it.
Because these shows, I didn't discuss this with Dylan, but we're going to announce the Good Trash Du Cinema now.
I hate that title.
We have to explain. Dalton hates pretension in itself, but we are doing just good trash because films are so rarely great art. But every once in a while, films themselves are great art. And you know what? Every once in a while, that geeky guy gets to go to the prom with that girl who's way too good for him. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to take, every now and again, we're going to take a look at some of those high art films. Suggestions have been Pulp Fiction, Manhattan by Woody Allen, and others. And
Seven Seals. I mean, when you think of the films you think of when you think of art films.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is going to include subtitles.
The Colors Trilogy. I mean, yeah.
We're going to talk a little black and white. We're going to talk a little bit outside the box of what that... And those are going to be dropped as bonus episodes. And
Are we going to make them part of our official count? We have them to sell. Let's talk about it right now on the air.
I don't even know what that question means.
This is episode 51 of the Good Trash Genre Cast.
It'll be a different count.
It'll be a spinoff.
Kind of. Gotcha. Okay, just checking.
It'll be a spinoff. It will be... I have thought about creating or suggesting that we create a separate iTunes account for it and then dropping it in both places, but I don't even know how to do that.
Yeah, kind of like just keeping the same, the one.
That's what I think.
One banner.
It'd be easier for everybody.
If we hire somebody, they can do that for us.
Right.
If we get to the point where we're getting money to do this, we'll do that.
Right. What would be a great day? Anyway, those shows themselves, though, they will be added of themselves. They'll have a number one, number two.
They'll have separate numbering. It'll be like the Spectacular Spider-Man versus the Amazing Spider-Man.
Or the Uncanny X-Men versus just those plain old Blue Squad X-Men. If you were reading the X-Men a lot in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. As you should have been. The Executioner's song, it needed to happen. Moving on.
We dropped some knowledge on you. So, you're announcing officially.
I'm announcing the Good Trash New Cinema episodes. One of them is in the can in the process of production even now, but probably won't be dropped for a month or two. And there are other films being watched for the sake of that. And we're very, very excited to gift you with that. And so, in the year 2014, you can look forward to not 52 1 week waits to listen to some Good Trash GenreCast crew talk about the movies and talk about what matters about those movies, but you will have yet even more, and I would not even begin to guess how many more than 50, but I would say we might make the 70s, yea, even the 80s. And
verily.
Verily I say unto you,
he's highballing it real hard right now, yes, listener.
Great joy.
Me and Arthur both just kind of looked at Dustin like, say what, Bob?
We're probably making the high 60s, early 70s. Moving on.
So it's time for what we do every week, right?
We got to talk about what's got us fired up this week in pop culture. Don't be fired up.
I am. Quite a bit. Yeah, a little bit. Okay. So this week, and when I say this week, I mean last night, Christmas night, I went and saw a little film by a filmmaker you might have heard of. He's been around for a while.
Did he have asthma?
He's dabbled in obscurity. And yeah, he had a serious case of asthma as a child. It's Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, which is the most flat-out bonkers movie I think I've ever seen. A scathing indictment of the debauchery of America's top 1%. A look behind the curtain about the nincompoops we allow to run the financial infrastructure of our country, and a look at how greed can corrupt, and absolute greed can corrupt absolutely. A really deeply fun and fascinating film, and weird and hilarious and dark, and Leonardo DiCaprio returns in what is probably the best performance of his entire career.
I put you on the horns of a decision that will be recorded forever in the annals of the internet. Will Leo win the Oscar for this performance? Finally.
Should he or will he?
Will he?
Will.
Probably not. Because he does cocaine out of a hooker's butt. And that is something I'm not kidding you. Look at me right now. Guys, I didn't just make that up. That's a thing that happens in this movie. And that's something the older members of the Academy aren't real keen on. Even though they've all probably done it.
Probably true.
That's fair.
Well, thank you, Dalton Stewart.
I also am fired up about a gift I got for Christmas. And that is an entry in the pop culture and philosophy series. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this series. It's a series of books that are a collection of academic
my
essays.
My life's ambition to write for it.
Yeah. I got Mad Men in Philosophy.
Nice.
From a friend of the show, Nick Sanford. I was very excited. Those of you who listen to the show more than once know I like Mad Men quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So quite excited about having that in my possession now. And that's it.
Excellent. Thank you, Dalton Stewart, for that. Arthur, are you fired up this week in pop culture?
You know, I am. First, I just want to address, if Leo didn't win an Oscar for Django Unchained, I don't know that's going to happen. I don't know who he pissed off at the Academy, but he made them royally mad.
I think he broke up with somebody's daughter.
I don't know.
He gets ignored that badly.
Yeah.
And I think he personally offended someone.
He has
painfully offended.
And it's not a matter of he's turned in one or two good performances, but probably 90% of the films he's been in since Titanic been great performances.
So the last, 15 years have just been...
The Departed. I'm just saying.
Yeah. He's good.
Oh, my God. I watched that this weekend for the first time in a couple of years. Oh, it's so great.
First time in a month, you mean? That's how often I love that movie.
Leonardo DiCaprio is this decade or this generation's Peter O'Toole.
You know what you can cut?
Oh, no, that's fair.
Like I was saying, I am continuing my quest to catch up on films from 2013. I've added The World's End as a notch on my bedpost. And then to that I added Nebraska, Saving Mr. Banks, American Hustle, and Side Effects.
Side Effects was good. How was American Hustle?
You know what? I still don't know how I feel about it.
Okay.
It's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the plot's problematic, I think.
Have you seen
that? But I defended this by the interview with David O. Russell, who said he really didn't care about plot because he was more worried about character. Huh. And for that, yeah, I'm on board. It's fun. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Okay.
But what else were you going to say?
I was just going to see in terms of the rest of it. Where does it, hold up?
You know, it's such a different feel.
Yeah.
Because it's this gangster kind of spy-ish, not espionage, but kind of undercover cop kind of thing.
I kind of get a certain Three Kings meets I Heart Huckabee's feel from it.
Maybe. You know, honestly, what I felt like when I was watching it, and I'm not putting this on the level of these other movies, but to me, it had a very Scarface, very Goodfellas type of feel.
Just in that.
And it's, I think it's part of the period,
mm-hmm.
but just the comedy in it, the way it's put together, the length, the way it runs, I think it fits more with those type of
films. It feels like one of those. Okay.
And so I thought it was good. Was it better than Silver Linings? Was it better than The Fighter? I think it's too hard to contrast.
It's funny you said that, because there are some moments in The Wolf of Wall Street that it very much feels like a companion piece to Goodfellas.
Yeah.
I mean, without a doubt.
A couple more things. Sorry. Just last couple things. I got some cool Christmas swag.
Yeah.
Excited about that. Got some movies. Got The Kings of Summer. I've been really dying to watch that one.
I have it from Netflix right now.
So, you know, Nick Overman, I'm happy to see that one. And the other thing, last thing, Paul Rudd is Ant-Man, which I'm on board with. So,
is that official?
Yeah. I can buy that. I
officialize it.
Cool.
I would have preferred Nathan Fillion, but yeah. I think that's fine.
I also would have been okay with Simon Pegg, which was a name I got thrown around.
That would have been fun.
Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
But Paul Rudd works for me.
You know what? I'll take it. I like Paul Rudd. He's goofy. He's fun.
Yeah, he can do it.
Yeah.
Dustin Sells. Master of Ceremonies for the last time in 2013. What's got you fired up in pop culture?
I know it's got me fired up in pop culture, and this is going to be very personal. I'm going to kind of do a Fincher rule violation and talk about those things which I love that are very personal, and one of those being the glassware given to me by Mr. Arthur Gordon, GTGC swag. For the first time ever, our logo and names are upon something in the real world, not the digital world, and I have to say, that pleases me to no end.
The ethereal Sasquatch provided something less than ethereal.
It was quite
concrete.
Solid.
Not for public consumption.
No. And so I'm very, very excited about that. And a couple things I mentioned on a week that got cut as they're about to take place is that this is a time of the year when I am no longer obligated to write papers and therefore free to pursue some of my other passions besides movies. Because when it's paper time, all I have are movies and papers and occasionally family. Sadly to say, I love you children, I really do, go away. That's what's said more often than not, because I'm either watching a movie or writing a paper. Now I am able to spend more time with my family, and I'm able to pursue one of my other great passions, which is hunting. And I will kill the pheasants, I have killed the elk, and hauled his carcass, and I'll be killing the antelope in, 36 hours. And I'm very, very excited about doing just that, assuming success and safety, and all that jazz. This is one of the things that I love to do, and it is a cultural phenomenon, more of the Duck Dynasty fashion, perhaps, than the movie-going entertainment fashion, but it's something I enjoy all the same. This is not an endorsement of Phil Robertson. Moving on, I am so glad we've had this conversation with you guys about Best Worst Movie. I am so excited to next week take a look at a movie that neither of my co-hosts have seen, to their shame. Nerddom must rebel. Cult action must take place because this is a cult film.
Science genre. Must have fiction.
It must. Shan't it?
Shall it?
Indeed. We must translate the Egyptian hieroglyphs and figure out the space aliens built the pyramids. That's right, dear listener. We're going to be looking at Stargate. And we're very, very excited to be looking at that and bringing some analysis.
I'm excited.
Is this Paul Verhoeven? Is this who's directing here?
This is not Paul Verhoeven, sadly.
Although it does seem like a movie he would make.
No.
I believe auteurism does not apply here. No, sadly, I don't think Verhoeven would make this film. In fact, I think he probably hates it.
Ooh.
I'm excited.
Scathing indictment.
From the Verhoeven, if you care what he thinks, stinking judgment, who cares?
I do. He made Showgirls.
It's the racist thing I've said ever.
That's xenophobic, not racist.
That's true. So yeah. I'm okay. Moving on, dear listener, we're so glad you have had this great 2013 with you all. We are at 51 episodes of content, and again, the reason why is so that we can have a conversation with you all, because guys, we obviously are people who enjoy one another's company and also enjoy movies and enjoy the conversation that surrounds all of that, but we want to share that conversation with you, and we want to engage in that conversation with you as well. We want you to see the articles that we're looking at. We want you to think the thoughts that you're thinking along with us, and we want you to help us be sharper, to be wiser, to be more incisive, to be more attentive to that which is before us. We think that there is some truth to the ancient proverb that says iron sharpens iron, and we want you to sharpen us, and you can do that via Twitter. Dalton, where are you at?
I can be located at Dal_stew on Twitter, and keep your iron away from me.
Arthur, where are you, sir?
You can find me at RNDTBLReview.
And Dustin Sells, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Finally, I'm at Dustin_Sells, SELLS, shaken, not stirred. And we look forward to having more conversation with you. Take a look at Stargate. It may have been a minute or never, shockingly. And we will...
We'll see you in 2014.
We'll see you in 2014. We'll see you next time, and we're looking forward to more conversation with you. We'll see you then.
Do you see this writing? Do you know what it means? Hospitality. And you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it!
What are you going to do to me, Daddy?
Tighten my belt by one loop so I don't feel hunger pains. And your sister and mother will have to do likewise.
Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Row your boat merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Life is but a dream. Life is but a dream. Life is but a dream.
I really just have one question.
Yeah, what's that?
Do you want to watch Troll 2?
I mean, kind of.
You want to watch it right now?
No, not at all. Not even a little bit.